talk is about that semi-definite programs which all look the same. So I'm going to explain this in a lot of detail what this means. So at the beginning, what is a semi-definite program? I mean, for a lot of you, the detailed introduction might get boring, but I mean, I looked at the list and not everybody works on SDP. So I'll give an introduction. So we are a linear objective function, and we have this linear matrix inequality, so that the B minus summation xi ai has to be positive semi-definite. So the ai's are symmetric matrices, B is a symmetric matrix, and you know what positive semi-definiteness means. Now, SDPs come in a different shape sometimes. So we can take the inner product of two symmetric matrices. So our matrix variable is y, then objective function is b, so we want to look for the infimum of b dot y. Y has to be a positive semi-definite, and we have linear equality constraints on the y. So why is so what is common between linear and semi-definite programming? First of all, of course, you can model linear programming as SDP by choosing diagonal matrices. But the common framework, which I'm going to come to later on, that both the non-negative orthant, which shows up in linear programming, and the set of PSD matrices, they form a closed convex cone. A cone is a set which contains all the non-negative multiples. And in SDP and in LP, you have linear and conic constraints and linear objective function. So I'll just talk a little bit about the duality theory, because that's what that is the subject of the talk. So conic duality was essentially invented by Duff in 1956. So he was the first one who thought that studying convex optimization problems, which are in a conic form, would be very interesting. And the reason is that the duality theory becomes very, very nice. I mean, it's much, much neater than general, you know, Fanshawe duality or Lagrange duality. And then there was a sequence of papers, and that time they didn't look at semi-definite programming, more like at general conic programming. And of course, they looked at duality theory mainly because there were no algorithms really at that time to solve these problems. And later there, and when semi-definite duality came around, there were some like Shapiro, Borwein, and Wolkowitz who introduced the Fisher reduction approach, and some others. And there is a, so I'm going to just briefly show a number of surveys and textbooks. So there's this, you know, the handbook of semi-definite programming, and that has material about duality theory. And then there's a survey of Vandenberg and Boyd, and then the textbook, and there's a number of textbooks on convex optimization, which are out now. And there's a nice talk by Sam Bührer on SDP that also talks about duality. So there is a related problem, and I want to review that, which is you take a closed convex cone and a linear image of that closed convex cone, and then you're asking, you know, is the image of it closed or not? And it may or may not be. And it's a very, very fundamental question in convex analysis. And considering that, very few people actually looked at this. So there's this classic theorem 9.1 in Rockefeller's book, and it's chapter 9, which the entire chapter is devoted to its closedness criteria. And there are very few others, like there's three others that I know of. And then I wrote a paper in 2007, which I'm going to use in this talk. And then basically this is it. There is not a whole lot else. That basically concludes the literature survey. So now we look at the primal dual pair of semi-definite programs. So the two SDPs that I showed previously, those are actually primal and dual pair. So what do we know about this? So if we have a feasible X and a feasible Y, then the CX is less equal than the B dot Y. So that's easy, that's weak duality. If what we would like to have is, it would be nice to have an X and a Y which have equal objective values, and those would be obviously optimal. And that comes for free in linear programming, not in semi-definite programming. So in SDP, what we have is that we have all these pathologies, One of them is non-attainment, so that's why we have ins and sup, not mean and max. And the other thing is, which is even more strange, that we can have positive gaps. And I'll show you examples of this. So what are the pathologies? And again, I mean, this might get boring if you have seen these pathological instances many times, but it might not hurt to look at them again. So the smallest problem that we can look at is this problem. So we look at the supremum of 2x1 subject to this linear matrix inequality. So it has just one variable and 2 by 2 matrices, which is the smallest that we can get, obviously. So let's just go through the steps. So we put the x1 on the other side. Then this matrix has to be positive semi-definite, and of course the x1 has to be 0, right? Because anytime the x1 is non-zero, the whole determinant would be negative. So x1 has to be 0, the supremum is attained. Now the dual, it takes one step to work out. We have a 2 by 2 semi-definite matrix, and this is the constraint. So this matrix has to be positive semi-definite, and we are infimizing the y11. And then, of course, the y11 can be arbitrarily close to 0. Just make the y11 small, and the y22, we blow it up. But it can never be exactly 0, right? Because 0 cannot be compensated by any kind of y22. So the infimum is 0, but the infimum is not attained, right? So the first kind of pathology is that there is no gap, but the dual doesn't attain. So the other pathology is we have positive gaps sometimes. So if you look at this problem, so this is bigger, I mean, 2 variables and 3 by 3 matrices. And if you put the x2 stuff on the other side, then you can see that for a similar reason as previously, the x2 has to be 0 all the time. So the supremum of x2 is 0, and it's attained, right? So that's what happens with the primal. And with the dual, I'm not going to work out what the dual is, but it's not very hard. The dual has value 1, and it's attained, right? So now, so there are 2 pathologies, and there's a 3rd one where the primal is finite and dual is not even feasible. So, I mean, you can think of it as a positive gap, like an infinite gap. Okay, so what we would like to do is we would like to find some sort of a characterization of that semi-definite programs, which is exact. We can verify it efficiently. Computing the answer, is this SDP badly behaved? That would be more ambitious, but we will settle for efficient verification now, and it should look nice, preferably. So that's what I would like to do. So the terminology is that, now I'm going to actually look at semi-definite systems, right? So when I said bad SDPs, that's a little bit of a cheating, because I'm going to look at whether a semi-definite system is well-behaved. I'm going to call it well-behaved if for every C where this supremum C transpose X over the P is finite, the dual has the same value and it attains it, right? So we can think of it that I call it well-behaved if it behaves like a polyhedron from the duality viewpoint. I mean, that's a loose way of saying it. As I call it well-behaved, otherwise I call it badly behaved. So we would like to understand badly behaved systems. So not just semi-definite programs. I want the thing to behave well for every C. So then here's the motivation. And so this is where the puzzle starts. So look at, we take those 2 systems that we looked at previously. So we get rid of the objective function, and then we put these next to each other. And it becomes kind of like a nice puzzle. Okay, so. And you know, it's kind of interesting because these showed up back in 96 in the surveys of Vandenberg and Boyd. And there, you know, when you look at these, there's this kind of weird sort of similarity, right? So there is somehow these 2 somehow look similar, right? And so it becomes almost like a combinatorial puzzle, which is nice because the whole thing is continuous. So there is 2 kinds of similarities between the 2 systems. The first one, the phenomenon of the hanging of diagonals. Okay, what is the hanging of diagonal? Well, the right hand side here is a positive semi-definite matrix, right? And then on the left hand side, you can see a matrix here But this one is sort of hanging off, right? That happens in the second system, and it also happens in the first system, right? So this is this one which is sort of hanging off, right? So that's strange. I mean, the question is, does it happen all the time? Another thing is that if in the second system, which is the larger, we sort of get rid of the first matrix, so just delete that, and in the rest, we delete the second row and second column everywhere, right? Then we get back the first system, right? So that means that the first system is actually contained in the second one, which is again something kind of odd. So the question is, do they all look the same? And this first minimal system, it's minimal in the sense that it has the smallest number of variables and smallest matrices, it is contained in everywhere. Okay, so the answer is going to be yes. And the technical it is that slack matrix is the difference between the right and the left hand sides, which has to be positive semi-definite. It's just like the slack vector in LP. And there is a maximum rank slack. I mean, that's an obvious fact. So for instance, here the maximum rank slack is just the right hand side because the left hand side is useless, right? And then the assumption that I'm going to make this new term is that we can do a rotation on all the AIs and all the Bs, okay? And this is a theorem. So assuming now without loss of generality, then the maximum rank slack looks like this, right? So maximum rank slack is a positive semi-definite matrix. If it's not in this form, then I just rotate everything so that it becomes in this form. And the bad behavior of P is true if and only if there is a V matrix, which is a linear combination of the AIs and of the B, which looks like this, right? Now, what does this mean? Here's an R by R identity. The V has to be a combination of the AIs and of the B, and there's absolutely no restriction on the V except this upper corner has to match the size of the identity in the slack, so it has to be an R by R, and this E1 is a first unit vector, right? So there's a 1 and lots of zeros, and there's a 0 here, and the rest doesn't matter. So this is an exact if and only if characterization. So this Z and V, well, we can think of them as their witnesses, that they are certifying the bad behavior. Okay, so let's look at the first system, just to convince ourselves that we are doing the right thing. So this is the first system. What is the maximum slack here? Well, that's just the right-hand side, right? So that's the Z, and then that's the first part of the certificate. And what is that V matrix? Well, that's the V, right? So on the first system, we can convince ourselves that this works. So the other question, which is totally unrelated, and it could be like a strange way of motivating this, the very unrelated question is that, I mentioned that, that little system is contained everywhere. So there's the issue whether we can draw a graph on the plane. And so like this graph is planar because we can pull out that edge and you can draw it on the plane. The theorem is that if something cannot be drawn on the plane, if and only if we can reduce it by a sequence of operations to these two minors. And I forgot to put an edge there, but you can believe that it's there. So this is a very loose motivation. And then, so what is the excluded minor for semi-definite programs? So our operations is going to be the following. The law of rotation, which is you rotate everything by the same invertible matrix. Contraction, well, we replace an AI matrix by a linear combination of AI matrices. And we replace the B by adding to it a combination of the AIs, right? So obviously these don't change anything, right? I mean, they don't change the feasible set or anything. And the deletion is we delete a row and column, the same index, or delete a matrix completely with the corresponding variable. And then the result is that if P is badly behaved, then we can get to this system, which is obviously badly behaved. So we can reduce every badly behaved system to this little one. And of course, it would be nicer if we had zero here, but we don't. So alpha can be anything. So that's the excluded minor type of characterization here. Okay, so complexity, what does this mean in terms of, so I don't know, is this all right so far? Okay, so that's the excluded minor characterization, which, you know, very loosely corresponds to excluded minors in graph theory. So now, so I said that, you know, these Z and V, they are witnesses, or like in computer science, you know, like there is no, yeah, sorry?
So you could get a zero if you allow the AI to be replaced by AI and get a V as well, which corresponds to a projective transformation on the
left. So if you mean adding the right-hand side to the left-hand side? Yeah, but I mean, you're right about that.
It's a much weirder sort of transformation, but in some sense it might preserve bad behavior if you change the definition a little bit. You know, I just wondered if you, because if you did that, then you can get the replacement to the zero.
That's true. You're right about that. The thing is that if you add the right-hand side to the left-hand side, that can make an infeasible problem feasible and vice versa. It can make a feasible problem infeasible, and but you're right about that. Then I could get the zero as well. So I didn't consider that because you know that messes things up much more than I mean I sort of have to justify why these transformations make sense. So the complexity is that if we use these witnesses, they're actually going to do what we expect from certificates in computer science. So in the real number of computing, that says that you can add square root 2 and square root 5 and store it in one unit of memory. But we use that. Okay, and why do we do that? Because semi-definite programs, of course, can have irrational solutions or lots of digits. So then, if everything is in unit time and unit memory, then that's not an issue. And the corollary is that in this model, is this question, is this system badly behaved, that's in NP intersect QNP. So it's reasonably, that's a good characterization. So in other words, we can verify in polynomial time that the system is well or badly behaved. Okay? So now I come to the more general result, which is actually, I mean, I talked about SDPs because it's very easy to visualize what happens there, right? Those matrices are just so easy to see what's going on. So the more general result is about conic linear programs. And so this is a more general thing, and what I talked about first is going to be a special case. So this is a conic linear system with this conic constraint, AX, K less or equal than B. In other words, the B minus AX has to be in K, where K is a closed convex cone. So now we can look at the supremizing C transpose X over this system. It has a dual. The dual has K star, which is the dual cone. And I won't write it out, but you can believe that. And so the concept of well-behaved and badly behaved is entirely analogous. Right, so you know, for every C which the primal is finite, the dual has to attain and has to attain the same value. So now, what is known about this? The known things are, of course, if K is a polyhedral cone, then P is a polyhedron, so then the system is well behaved, right? And the other thing is that if P is strictly feasible, so if there exists an x, so that this b minus ax is in the relative interior of the cone k, then again p is well behaved, right? So the first thing is polyhedral theory. The second is Duffin's result back from the 50s. So what is missing from these two conditions? Well, what is missing is that they are sufficient conditions, but they are not necessary. And they are completely independent of each other, right? So you can have stator points without polyhedrality and vice versa. So what would be really beautiful, and I won't quite get there, but what would be nice is to have an if and only if characterization. So let's, how do we get there? So it's a totally obvious definition, like, you know, nonlinear programming 101, but just to make sure that we are on the same page. So the set of feasible directions is this set, the DZK, the set of vectors, so that you can add a little bit of it to the Z and remain in the cone. And I'm not showing you the cone, I'm showing the cross section. So like you see that this is a direction, and this is something which is in the closure of the feasible direction, but it's not a direction itself, right? So it's a convex set, but it may not be closed. That's a very basic set. So here's the result. So we take Z to be a maximum slack in this, and I don't define it precisely, but that's basically in the relative interior of the set of all slacks, which is a convex set. And there's the K is a set of feasible directions at Z in K. Right? So that's the important set. And so here's the first result. So remember, yeah? Oh, it's in the relative interior of, yes, anything, yeah. Doesn't have to be distinguished, because everything that I state later on will depend on that being a maximum slack. Doesn't have to be anything specific. So here's a result, that P is well-behaved. That implies that you take the range space of AB, that operator which comes together by sticking together the left and right-hand side, and you intersected it with this pesky set, that the closure of the feasible directions minus the feasible directions, okay? Then this set has to be empty, right? So one interesting thing about this is that, first of all, this is a necessary condition, right? So anytime P is well-behaved, then this has to be true. And necessary conditions, they just haven't been known. So this is despite the fact that, I mean, what kind of concepts are we using here? I mean, feasible directions, right? So nothing that hasn't been known for Duffin or for anybody later on. So this is a very simple necessary condition. And why is it also nice? Because it's very easy to check that those two other conditions, the polyhedrality and the slaterness, imply this, right? I suppose K is polyhedral, then the set of feasible directions is a polyhedral cone, so it's closed, so then this set is empty, and an intersection with that is also empty. I suppose that Z is in the interior, right? In other words, we have strict feasibility. Then again, I mean, what is the feasible directions if you're in the interior of the cone? Then you can just go any way you want. So that's a whole space, or if it's not full dimensional, then it's a subspace. So again, then this is an empty set. So the intersection is an empty set. So these are totally, so trivially satisfied when those two conditions are true. Okay, and then but then this is still just a necessary condition. We want something which is necessary and sufficient. Now that comes with a little extra cost. So if I look at this set, face ZK is the smallest face of the cone that contains Z, right? So that you know what faces are, and I add that to K star. I add not that set, but the perp of it. So strictly speaking, you take the subspace spanned by that set and take the perp of that. And then if this is closed, then you have equivalence. So actually, at a little extra cost. So now, what does this imply? So first corollary, if K is polyhedral, then P is well-behaved. Of course, we knew that, but that's a corollary now, because if K is polyhedral, then this is true. This set is empty, so then this condition is true. And this is also a closed set, because K star is polyhedral, polyhedral plus subspace is polyhedral, so therefore it's closed. And if P is strictly feasible, what does that mean? It means that this phase ZK is K itself, so you get K star plus K perp, that's K star, and that's closed, right? So if P is strictly feasible, then this is true, and this is true, therefore, we get as a corollary that P is well-behaved. And of course, we knew that, but then we unify these two conditions, which don't seem to be related, right? So, but they are. So it gets even better, in a sense, because now we have this one condition, and then we say that, well, if this is true, then we have equivalence. And so it turns out that this extra condition comes for free a lot of the time, right? So how does it come for free? Well, I'm going to call those cones nice, where the K star plus F third is closed for all spaces. So not just for any specific face of the cone, but for all faces. And nice cones are surprisingly abundant, right? So, actually, maybe I won't come to that yet. So nice cones are supposedly widespread. Polyhedral cones, semi-definite cones, second-order cones, and P cones are all nice, right? So in a lot of the times, the K star plus F perf being closed, that comes for free. And then P is well-behaved, if and only if that star condition is true. Now, I'm going to show right now what the star condition is. It means that the range space of AB intersect with the closure of directions ZK minus dir ZK is empty. So this is the star condition. So under the assumption that K is a nice cone, we have an if and only if characterization. So just that one simple condition perfectly characterizes good behavior. Now, if you turn this around, why is that good? Because then if it's badly behaved, then there is the Z, which is the maximum slack, and then it has to exist a guy in this difference set, right? In the RAB and the closure of directions minus the directions, right? So anytime it's badly behaved, we get these Z and V, which are the certificates. And, well, those cones are nice. So let's recall that bad SDP theorem with those matrices. So what was the Z? The Z was the maximum rank slack. So the same thing as the maximum slack in the general framework. And then we had this V, which was easy to visualize, but then the geometric interpretation of this is that this V is not a feasible direction at Z, right? Because if you add any multiple of this V to Z, you don't get a semi-definite matrix, right? Because the one here is not compensated by anything. So it's not a feasible direction. But I can make it a feasible direction by an arbitrarily small perturbation. So I can stick a little epsilon here. No matter how small that positive epsilon is, it's going to become a feasible direction. So this V is in this closure of directions minus directions. So that mysterious looking Z and V gets a natural interpretation in the geometric framework. Okay, so that's the that's how the bad SDP theorem relates to the general result. Okay, so what is the background of this? So remember that we had this system, which was AX, K less or equal than B. So suppose that B is zero, the system is homogeneous, then when is P well-behaved? Well, well-behaved means that any time the objective of a linear function is finite, you know, something happens. So if when you maximize a linear objective function of a homogeneous set, then it's either zero or infinity. And it takes a little bit of thought to figure out that P is well behaved if and only if the A star K star is a closed set, right? So applying the joint operator to K star gives you a closed set. And then we get like the characterization of the closedness of A star K star in my paper, which was in 2007. So this general result can be viewed as an inhomogeneous version of the homogeneous result. I mean, it takes quite a bit of work to get there, but that's the background. Okay, so actually I might be going too fast, but I guess there's just a bit more time for questions. Like, how much time do I have? 20? How much? 30, but 10 for questions, right? Okay, so yeah. Okay, so then second order conic system. So I said, as I said, second order cones are also nice. So the general geometric result is going to apply to second order conic systems, and also to systems which have direct products of second order cones. So second order conic system is this when the K is a product of the KIs, and the KI is the second order cone. So they are potentially of different dimension. And here's a badly behaved system. This time I'm not going to work out the details, but it's not hard to convince ourselves. And one thing that is easy to see that, you know, this doesn't have a strictly feasible point. I mean, actually, it's not hard to see that the x1 has to be zero all the time, right? Because this is already on the boundary of the second order cone, so adding anything, any multiple of this would just take us out of there. Okay, so second order systems are kind of nastier in the sense that, it's a simpler cone, but we have to look at direct products, otherwise it's not very interesting. So now the theorem is a little bit more complicated than the SDP theorem. So suppose that the maximum slack in that system, which has all those second order cones, is of this form. A bunch of zeros, and then we have a bunch of vectors which are on the boundary of the second order cone. So, why do I assume that without loss of generality? Because again, we can do a rotation on the second order cone, and it doesn't change the feasible set. So these guys are zero, these guys are non-zero, but they're on the boundary, and these guys are in the interior, right? And then the theorem is that P is badly behaved if and only if we can find a V which is in the range space of the enlarged operator of the AB of the form that the VIs have to be in the cones for these indices, right? So the VI1 has to be V greater than VI2 for everybody here. So zero means zero. R means ray, right? Because those are rays of the second order cone. So here, the V has to have a non-negative inner product with these guys, right? And it has to be at least one index that J is in R, such that the VJ has this form, right? So it has exactly zero inner product with one of these guys, right? So it's alpha one and something else. So this has to be true for at least one component. Okay? So this is the exact characterization for second order conic systems. So in the example that we have this system, right? Here, what is the maximum slack? Well, the x1 has to be zero all the time. The maximum slack is basically just the right-hand side, nothing else. And then what is the O? That's the indices where we are zero. So that's an empty set. I is the set where we have to be in the interior. That's again an empty set. So R is just this, right? So that's the index set. And so the Z, which is the maximum slack, that's just the right-hand side, right? Because we can completely ignore everything which is on the left-hand side. Those are zero anyway. And then this is the V, which is the certificate. So the VJ has this form alpha and one. Right? So we can quickly check that this actually works out. And we can actually check this on everything, right? So we can take whichever textbook we like, and then you know we can find those minors there. Okay, so then there is one more result that I want to talk about. So then I said that, you know, we can characterize badly behaved systems through the existence of the Z and the V, right? So then what is the well-behaved system where the V does not exist, right? But that's not really a very good characterization. We want something better. So there's an interesting distinction between well and badly behaved systems. So let's look at this system, right? So what can we say about this system? Well, the first thing that we can say is that this obviously doesn't have a strictly feasible point, right? So, but actually the x1 has to be zero all the time, right? So if you add any multiple of this matrix to the right-hand side, you get something which is not positive semi-definite. The second thing that we can notice is that the feasible, that this is actually a well-behaved system. And that despite the fact that you could say that, well, you already showed us this system, right? So there was this first little badly behaved system with 2x2 matrices, which was badly behaved. And this very much looks like this, but it's not the same, obviously, because I don't know if it's obvious, but in the first system, these ones were shifted up, right? So it's very much not the same. And this is actually well behaved. It's very easy to check. So we want to characterize well-behaved systems. And the characterization is, again, that we're assuming that the maximum slack is of this form. So we're going to identity up the upper left corner. And then there are two things have to be true in order for the system to be well-behaved. The first, there is a U, which is strictly complementary to the Z. Right? So it's identity in the opposite block. And the U is orthogonal to the B and orthogonal to all the AIs. And the second is a bit more complicated. So anytime you take a linear combination of the AIs and the B, which happens to have zero in this down corner, it also has to be the case that the V12 is zero. Right, so these are a little a little bit more difficult to digest than the characterization of the badly behaved systems, but it's kind of it's actually not very hard to check this on the first system. So we have zero. Okay. So what is the Z here? The Z is just the right hand side, right? So this is 1, 0, 0. So what is the U, which is strictly complementary to the Z and orthogonal to the A1 and orthogonal to the B? Well, that's just 0, 1, 1. So we have the first piece of the puzzle. And the second thing is that any time I take a V, which is a combination of this and this, and it has a zero down here, it also has to have a zero up here. Right? And that's easy to check. So why is this, so why are these easy to verify? And actually this gives part of the, gives an answer to part of the puzzle why good behavior is efficiently verifiable, because I have to verify two things. I have to verify that this U is orthogonal to everything and it's strictly complementary. I mean, that's trivial. It's just linear algebra. And the second thing that I have to verify that anytime I take a combination of these matrices and we get zero here, then we get zero there. But again, that's just linear algebra, right? So this gives an answer why good behavior is in NP, because we can verify it. Okay, so actually I came to the end a little faster than I thought, so I guess you can ask more questions. So the duality, now why is it important in semi-definite programming? For the same reason as in linear programming, because that's how we know that we solve the problem. We find a dual solution which has the same value as the primal, and then that's a certificate of optimality. But then we have these pathologies. The pathologies are that we have non-attainment in the dual, we have positive gaps, or even infeasibility of the dual. And the main result is that all the pathologies have a simple structure which is underlying it. And the one way of phrasing it is that it is hanging off one structure. The hanging off one structure, which you can see in every instance in the textbook, is that it has to be there all the time. And then we have this excluded minor type theorem, which is that everything can be reduced to that one little system. And all that actually comes from a general result for general conicalities. And here the thing to sort of focus on is this strange set, the closure of the directions minus the directions. So that's a very key point. The set is empty in polyhedral cones, and if the Z is in the interior. And then I guess the bad SVP result is what is easy to see and understand, because you can visualize things. But then on top of that, we can characterize good SVPs, bad SOCPs, good SOCPs, and whatnot. I mean, we can do quite a lot, and that is in the paper. So thank you for your attention.